Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, good morning. This is your host, Cedric Shabazz from God Brother Radio on this beautiful Sunday morning. Folks, we're going to have a 30-minute show today, and it's going to be called The History of Russia from the Years of 800 till 1920. So it's going to be a show that sounds like I'm reading from a book or a script. So let's just let you know that I am reading information, doing for my research, and so we're going to start this off. It's going to be about 30 minutes, and it's going to be pretty consistent, and I'm going to be going pretty fast. So welcome to God Brothers Radio, and we're going to start in just now. So we're going to start off with ancient Russia from the years 800 to 1200, and we're going to start with the early history of Russia, like those of many countries, is one of migrating peoples and ancient kingdoms. In fact, early Russia was not exactly Russia, but a collection of cities that gradually consented into an empire. First, in the early part of the 9th century, as part of the same great movement that brought the Danes to England and the Norsemen to Western Europe, a Scandinavian people known as the Bergarians crossed the Baltic Sea and landed in Eastern Europe. Now, the leader of the Bergarians was the semi-legendary warrior Rurik, who led his people in 1862 to the city of Novgorod on the Volkhov River. Now, whether Rurik took the city by force or was invited to rule there, he certainly invested the city. Now, from Novgorod, Rurik's successor Oleg extended the power of the city southward. In 882, he gained control of Kiev, a Slavic city that had arisen along the Dnieper River around the 5th century. Oleg's attainment of rule over Kiev marks the first establishment of a unified dynastic state in the region. Kiev became the center of trade route between Scandinavia and Constantinople, and Kievan Rus, as the empire came to be known, flourished for the next 300 years. Now, by 989, Oleg's great-grandson Vladimir I was ruler of a kingdom that extended to as far south as the Black Sea, the Caucasus Mountains, and the lower reaches of the Volga River. Now, having decided to establish a state religion, Vladimir carefully considered a number of available faiths and decided upon Greek Orthodoxy, thus allying himself with Constantinople and the West. It is said that Vladimir decided against Islam partly because of his belief that his people could not live under a religion that prohibits hard liquor. Now, Vladimir was succeeded by Yusulab the Wise, whose reign marked the apogee of Kievan Rus. Now, Yusulab's codified laws made shrewd alliances with other states and encouraged the arts. Ultimately, he decided in the end to act like Lear, dividing his kingdom among his children and binding them to cooperate and flourish. And, of course, they did nothing of the sort. Now, within a few decades of Yaroslav's death in 1054, Kievan Rus had broken up into regional power centers. Internal divisions were made worse by the depredations of the invading Cumans, better known as the Kipchaks. It was during this time, in 1147 to be exact, that Yuri Dolokhrusly, one of the regional princesses, held a feast at his hunting lodge atop a hill overlooking the confluence of the Moskva and the Dnieper rivers. A chronicle recorded the party, this providing us with the earliest mention of Moscow, that small settlement that will soon become the preeminent city in Russia. The Mongols and the emergence of Moscow from the year 1237 to 1613. Now, Kievan Rus struggled on into the 13th century, but was decisively destroyed by the arrival of a new invader, the Mongols. In 1237, Batu Khan, a grandson of the Genghis Khan, launched an invasion into Kievan Rus from his capital on the lower Volga at present-day Kazan. Over the next 3 years, the Mongols, or Tatars, destroyed all of the major cities of Kievan Rus, with the exceptions of Novgorod and Pskov. The regional princesses were not deposed, but they were forced to send regular tribute to the Tsar's state, Tatar state, which became known as the Empire of the Golden Horde. Now, invasions of Russia were attempted during the period from the west as well, first by the Swedes in 1240 and then by the Litovin Brothers of the Sword, 1242, a regional branch of the fearsome Teutonic Knights. In the best news of the era for Russia, both were decisively defeated by the great warrior Alexander Nevsky, a prince of Novgorod who earned his surname from his victory over the Swedes on the Neva River. Now, for the next few century or so, very little seems to have happened in Russia, which other than the exorbitant tax requirement was relatively left alone by the Mongols. Now, with the Tatars off to the southwest, the northeastern cities gradually gained more influence, first Tver, and then around the turn of the 14th century, Moscow. As a sign of the city's importance, the Patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church was transferred to the city, making it the spiritual capital of Russia. By the later part of the century, Moscow felt strong enough to challenge the Tatars directly, and in 1380, a Muscovite prince named Dmitry Donskoy had the audacity to attack them. His decisive victory at Kislovodsk Field immediately made him a popular hero. Though the Tatar retaliation 2 years later maintained their rule over the city, it wasn't until 1480, after another century had passed, that Moscow was strong enough to throw off Tatar's rule for good. His ruler at the time was Grand Duke Ivan III, better known as Ivan the Great. Ivan began by subjugating most of Moscow's rival cities, and by the time he tore up the charter binding it to Tatar's tribute, he was effectively in control of the entire country. However, it wasn't until the reign of his grandson, Ivan the Terrible, that Russia became a unified state. Now, Ivan the Terrible succeeded his father, Vasily III, as Grand Duke of Moscow in 1533 at the age of 3. His mother served as a regent until she died, too. Now, when Ivan was 8, for the next 8 years, the young Grand Duke endured a series of regents chosen from among the boyars or the nobility. Finally, in 1547, he adopted the title of Tsar and set about crushing the powers of the boyars. Now, reorganizing the military and preparing to smite the Tatars, in 1552 he conquered and sacked Kazan, the famous St. Basil's Cathedral was built in commemoration of this victory, and in 1556, Astrakhan, having this destroyed the lingering power of the Golden Horde, Ivan the Tatar's campaign opened a vast new area for Russian expansion, and it was during his reign that the conquest and the colonization of Siberia began. Believe it or not, Ivan was not supposed to have been very terrible at all during the early years of his reign. However, as he grew older, his temper worsened, and by the 1560s, he carried out a pretty horrific campaign against the boyars, confiscating their land, executing or exiling those who displeased him. In 1581, in a rage, he struck his son and heir Ivan with an iron rod, killing him. When Ivan the Terrible died in 1584, he was succeeded by his son Fyodor, who left most of the management of the kingdom to his brother-in-law Boris Godunov, and it was not long before Godunov began to work to secure the succession for himself. In 1591, he murdered Fyodor's young brother Dmitry in the ancient town of Ugich, a spot now marked by the magnificent church of St. Demetrius on the Blood. Now, when Fyodor died in 1598, Godunov was made Tsar, but his rule was never accepted as entirely legitimate. Within a few years, a pretender arose in Poland, claiming to be Dmitry, and in 1604, he invaded Russia. Godunov died suddenly the next year, and the time of troubles began. For the next 8 years, both the first and the second false Dmitry laid claims to the throne, both supported by invading Polish armies. Finally, in 1613, the Poles were ousted from Moscow, and the boyars unanimously elected Michael Romanov as Tsar. The Romanov dynasty was to rule Russia for the next 304 years until the Russian Revolution brought an end to the Tsar's state. The Romanovs, from the year 1613 to 1825. For the first few generations, the Romanovs were happy to maintain the status quo in Russia. They continued to centralize power, but they did very little to bring Russia up to speed with the rapid changes in economic and political life that were taking place elsewhere in Europe. Peter the Great decided to change all that. Peter was his father's youngest son and the child of his second wife. When his father, Tsar Alexis, died in 1676, Peter's brother Fyodor became Tsar, but his poor health brought an early death in 1682. The family of Peter's mother succeeded in having him chosen over his mentally retarded brother Ivan to be Tsar. But no sooner was he established than Ivan's family struck back. Gaining the support of the Kremlin Guard, they launched a coup d'etat, which resulted in a joint tsarship, with Peter and Ivan placed under regency of Ivan's elder sister Sophia. In 1689, just as Peter was to come of age, Sophia attempted another coup. By this time, however, she was defeated and confined to the Novodevichy convent. 6 years later, Ivan died, leaving Peter in sole possession of the throne. Rather than taking up residence and ruling Moscow, his response was to embark on a grand tour of Europe. He spent about 2 years there, not only meeting monarchs and conducting diplomacy, but also traveling incognito and even working as a ship's carpenter in Holland. He amassed a considerable body of knowledge on Western European industrial techniques and state administration and became determined to modernize the Russian state and to westernize society. In 1698, still on tour, Peter received news of yet another rebellion by the Kremlin Guard, instigated by Sophia, despite her confinement to Novinsky. He returned, defeated the coup attempt, and hung all of the rebels. The following day, he began his program to recreate Russia in the image of Western Europe by personally clipping off the beards of his nobles. Peter's return to Russia hit the country like a hurricane. He banned traditional Muscovite dress for all men. He introduced military conscription, established technical schools, replaced the church's hierarchy with the Holy Synod answerable to himself, simplified the alphabet, tried to improve the manners of the court, changed the calendar, changed his titles from Tsar to Emperor, and introduced 100 other reforms, restrictions, and novelties. In 1703, he transformed the capital from Moscow to a new city to be built from scratch on the Gulf of Finland. Over the next 9 years, at tremendous human and material costs, St. Petersburg was created. Peter himself died in 1725, and he remains one of the most controversial figures in Roman history. Although he was deeply committed to making Russia a powerful new member of modern Europe, it is questionable whether his reforms resulted in a significant improvement on the lives of his subjects. Certainly, he modernized Russia's military and its administrative structure, but both of these reforms were financed at the expense of the peasantry, who were increasingly forced into serfdom. After Peter's death, Russia went through a great number of rulers in a distressingly short time, none who had much of opportunity to leave a lasting impression. Many of Peter's reforms failed to take root in Russia, and it was not until the reign of Catherine the Great that his desire to make Russia into a great European power was in fact achieved. Catherine the Great. The future Catherine the Great was born a German princess in one of the tiny German states, but turned out to be a powerful and enlightened ruler of the vast Russian Empire. In 1745, she was married to Prince Karl Peter Ulbricht, the heir to the Russian throne, the future emperor Peter III. Now, being a bright personality with a strong sense of determination, she joined the Russian Orthodox Church, learned the Russian language, and by doing a lot of reading, acquired a brilliant education. In June 1762, she took an active part in a coup against her husband, Emperor Peter III. He was overthrown and soon killed in an accident, while Catherine became Russia's ruler. Catherine went on to become the most powerful sovereign in Europe. She continued Peter the Great's reforms of the Russian state, further increasing central control over the provinces. Russia's influence in European affairs, as well as its territory in Eastern and Central Europe, were increased and expanded. Catherine was also an enthusiastic patron of the arts. She built and founded the Hermitage Museum, commissioned buildings all over Russia, founded academies, journals, and libraries, and corresponded with the French encyclopedias, including Voltaire, Diderot, and Albert. Although Catherine did in fact have many lovers, some of them trusted advisors and confidants, stories alleging her to have an excessive sexual appetite are unfounded. With the onset of the French Revolution, Catherine became strikingly conservative and increasingly hostile to criticism of her policies. From 1789 until her death, she reversed many of the liberal reforms of her early reign. One notable effect of this reversal was that, like Peter the Great, Catherine ultimately contributed to the increasingly distressing state of the peasantry in Russia. When Catherine the Great died in 1796, she was succeeded by her son Paul I. Paul's reign lasted only 5 years and was by all accounts a complete disaster. Paul was succeeded by his son Alexander I, who is remembered mostly for having been the ruler of Russia during Napoleon Bonaparte's epic Russian campaign. Once again, this is Cedric Shabazz of the God Brothers radio station. I'm reading the history of Russia from certain years, I think from the year 800 to 1920. And we start the next segment called Napoleon Invasion, live from Sin City, Las Vegas. In June of 1812, Napoleon began his fatal Russian campaign, a landmark in the history of the destructive potential of warfare. Virtually all of continental European was under his control, and the invasion of Russia was an attempt to force Tsar Alexander I to submit once again to the terms of a treaty that Napoleon had imposed upon him 4 years earlier. Now, having gathered nearly 500,000 soldiers from France, as well as all of the vassal states of Europe, Napoleon entered Russia at the head of the largest army ever seen. The Russians, under Marshal Kutuzov, could not realistically hope to defeat him in a direct confrontation. Instead, they began a defensive campaign of strategic retreat, devastating the land as they fell back and harassing the flanks of the French. As the summer wore on, Napoleon's massive supply lines were stretched over ever thinner, and his force began to decline. By September, without having engaged in a single pitched battle, the French army had been reduced by more than two-thirds from fatigue, hunger, desertions, and raids by Russian forces. Nonetheless, it was clear that unless the Russians engaged the French army in a major battle, Moscow would be Napoleon's in a matter of weeks. The Tsar insisted upon an engagement, and on September 7th, with winter closing in and the French army only 70 miles or 110 kilometers from the city, the two armies met at Borodino Field. By the end of the day, 108,000 men had died, but neither side had gained a decisive victory. Kutuzov realized that any further defense of the city would be senseless, and he withdrew his forces, prompting the citizens of Moscow to begin a massive and panicked exodus. Now, when Napoleon's army arrived on September 14th, they found the city depopulated and bereft of supplies, a meager comfort in the face of the uncommon winter. To make matters much, much worse, fires broke out in the city that night, and by the next day the French were lacking shelter as well. Now, after waiting in vain for Alexander to offer to negotiate, Napoleon ordered his troops to begin the march home. Now, because the route south was blocked by the Kutuzov's forces and the French were in no shape for a battle, the retreat retraced the long, devastated route of the invasion. Having waited until mid-October to part, the exhausted French army soon found itself in the midst of winter. In fact, in the midst of an unusually early and especially cold winter, temperatures soon dropped well below freezing. Cossacks attacked stragglers and isolated units. Food was almost non-existent, and the march was 500 miles. 10,000 men survived. The campaign ensured Napoleon's downfall and Russia's status as a leading power in post-Napoleonic Europe. Yet even as Russia emerged powerful than ever, the Napoleonic era, its internal tensions began to increase. The path to revolution from 1825 to 1920, and it starts like this. Now, since the reign of Ivan the Terrible, the Russian czars had followed a very consistent policy of drawing more political power away from the nobility into their own hands. Now, this centralization of authority in the Russian state had been accomplished in one of two ways, either by simply taking power from the nobles and braving their opposition. Now, Ivan the Terrible was very good at this, or by compensating the nobles for decreased power in government by giving them greater power over their land and its occupants. Now, serfdom, as this latter system was known, had increased steadily in Russia from the time of Ivan the Terrible, its inventor. By the time of Catherine the Great, the Russian czars enjoyed virtually autocratic rule over their nobles. However, they had in a sense purchased this power by granting those nobles virtually autocratic power over the serfs, who by this time had been reduced to a state closer to slavery than peasantry. By the 19th century, both of these relationships were under attack. In the December Revolt in 1825, a group of young men, reformist military officers, attempted to force the adoption of a constitutional monarchy in Russia by preventing the accession of Nicholas I. They failed utterly, and Nicholas became the first reactionary leader in Europe. Nicholas' successor, Alexander II, seemed by contrast to be amenable to reform. In 1861, he abolished serfdom. Through the emancipation didn't in fact bring on any significant change in the condition of his peasants. They were still poor, without nothing. As the country became more industrialized, its political system experienced even greater strain. Attempts by the lower classes to gain more freedom provoked fear of anarchy, and the government remained extremely conservative. As Russia became more industrialized, larger, and far more complicated, the inadequacies of an aristocratic czarist rule became increasingly apparent. By the 20th century, conditions were ripe for a serious convulsion. At the same time, Russia had expanded its territory and its power considerably over the 19th century. Its borders extended to Afghanistan and China, and it had acquired extensive territory on the Pacific coast. Now, the foundation of the port cities of Vladivostok and Port Arthur there had opened up profitable avenues for commerce, and the construction of the Trans-Siberian Railway, constructed from 1891 to 1905, linked the European Russian with its new eastern territories. Now, in 1894, Nicholas II ascended to the throne. He was not the most competent of political leaders, and his ministers were almost uniformly reactionaries. Now, to make matters worse, the increasing Russian presence in the Far East provoked the hostility of Japan. In January of 1905, the Japanese attacked, and Russia experienced a series of defeats that dissolved the tenuous support held by Nicholas' already unpopular government. Nicholas was forced to grant concessions to the reformers, including most notably a constitution and a parliament, or Duma. Now, the power of the reform movement was founded on a new and powerful force that entered Russian politics. The industrialization of the major Western cities and the development of the Batu oil fields had brought together large concentrations of Russian workers, and they soon began to organize into local political councils, or Soviets. Soviet means council or advice. It was in large part the power of the Soviets under the Social Democratic Party that had forced Nicholas to accept reforms in 1905. Now, after the war with Japan was brought to a close, Nicholas attempted to reverse the new freedoms, and his government became more reactionary than ever. Popular discontent gained strength, and Nicholas countered it with increased repression. In 1912, the Social Democrats split into two camps, the Radical Bolsheviks, Bolsh means bigger, and the comparatively moderate Mishviks, Mishning means smaller. In 1914, another disastrous war once again brought on a crisis. If the Russo-Japanese War had been costly and unpopular, it was at least remote. Now, the First World War, however, took place right on Russia's western doorstep. Unprepared military or industrially, the country suffered demoralizing defeats, suffered severe food shortages, and soon suffered an economic collapse. By February of 1917, The workers and soldiers had had enough. Riots broke out in St. Petersburg, then called Petrograd, and the garrisons there mutinied. Workers' Soviets were set up, and the Duma approved the establishment of a provisional government to attempt to restore order in the capital. It was soon clear that Nicholas possessed no support, and on March 2nd, he had abdicated the throne in favor of his brother, Michael. Michael, no fool, reannounced his claim the next day. The provisional government set up by the Duma attempted to pursue a moderate policy, calling for a return to order and promising reform of workers' rights. However, it was unwilling to endorse the most pressing demand of the Soviets, an immediate end to the war. For the next 9 months, the provisional government, first under Prince First Ivov and then under Alexander Kravinsky, unsuccessfully attempted to establish its authority. In the meanwhile, the Bolsheviks gained increasing support from the ever more frustrated Soviets. On October 25th, led by Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, they stormed the Winter Palace and deposed the Kerensky government. While the Bolsheviks enjoyed substantial support in St. Petersburg and Moscow, they were by no means in control of the country as a whole. They succeeded in taking Russia out of the war, though on very unfavorable terms, but within months, civil war broke out through Russia. For the next 3 years, the country was devastated by civil strife, until about 1920, the Bolsheviks had finally emerged as victorious. We have 4 minutes left on God Brothers Radio, and the next part is called the Soviet Era, and we're ending our show on this note, and then I would officially end the show. Thank you to listen to God Brothers Radio. This is Cedric Shabazz, live from Sin City, Las Vegas. The Soviet Era. The first few years of the Soviet rule were marked by the extraordinary outbursts of social and cultural change. While the Bolsheviks had maintained complete control of the economy during the Civil War, Lenin decided at its end that a partial return to a market economy would help the country recover from the destruction of the previous 3 years. His new economic policy, or NEP, brought about a period of relative prosperity, allowing the young Soviet government to consolidate its political position and rebuild the country's infrastructure. This was also the period during which the Russian avant-garde reached its height, developing the radical new styles of constructivism, futurism, and suprematism. Although the country still faced enormous challenges, there was at least a widespread sense of optimism and opportunity. Now, Lenin's death in 1924 was followed by an extended and extremely divisive struggle for power in the Communist Party. By the latter of the decade, Joseph Stalin had emerged as the victor, and he immediately set the country on a much different course. The NEP was scrapped to be replaced by an economic plan dictated from the top. Agricultural lands were collectivized, creating large state-run farms. Industrial development was pushed along at breakneck speed, and production was almost entirely diverted from consumer products to capital equipment. Art and literature were placed under much tighter control, and the radical energy of the Russian avant-garde was replaced by the solemn grandeur of Soviet realism. Religion was violently repressed as churches were closed, destroyed, or converted to other uses. Stalin purged all opposition to himself within the party, as well as opposition to party policy in the country. By the end of the 1930s, the Soviet Union had become a country in which life was more strictly regulated than ever before. Experimentation had ended, and discipline was the rule of day. Once again, this is Cedric Shabazz, and this is going to be part one of the history of Russia from 800 to 1930. And I'd just like to thank you for continuing to support God Brothers Radio. If you continue to want to support God Brothers Radio, please go to Zazzle.com, Zazzle.com/Cedric Shabazz, CDRICSHABAZZ, and purchase a God Brother t-shirt, a mug, a hoodie, or a hat, and I will continue to support God Brothers Radio. Thank you once again, and I'll see you next Saturday at God Brothers Radio. God bless.